And welcome back to the How to Be Good podcast. So our guest today, we've been waiting a long time for this interview, and it's actually been quite hard because we've had to reschedule it many, many times because he is incredibly busy. So today we are interviewing the well-renowned and fantastic Dr. Michael Greger.
And we need to give him an introduction. He probably doesn't need one, but we need to give him an introduction. And there is so much to say. I cannot possibly retain the amount of information that we need to give you. So I am going to read it this time. So Dr. Michael Greger is a physician, New York Times best-selling author, and internationally recognized professional speaker on a number of important public health issues. Dr. Greger has lectured at the Conference of World Affairs, the National Institutes of Health, and the International Bird Flu Summit, amongst countless other symposia and institutions. Testified before Congress, has appeared on shows such as Dr. Oz's show and the Colbert Report, and was invited as an expert witness in defense of Oprah Winfrey and the infamous Meat Defamation Trial. In 2017, he was honored with the ACLM Lifestyle Medicine Trailblazer Award.
And we're still going.
He's
done quite a bit. Yeah. So what else?
So Dr. Greger is also licensed as a general practitioner, specializing in clinical nutrition, and is a founding member and fellow of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. Dr. Greger's nutrition work can be found on nutritionfacts.org, which is a registered non-profit charity. And all the work that he shares there is completely free.
An amazing website. You can get everything from information about what certain foods are good for, are bad for. There's recipes. There's loads and loads of videos as well about talks that he's done and lots of things like that. So it's a very, very valuable place to go. And we'll make sure that we include that in the show notes too.
He is also the author of Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, and the Carbophobia, The Scary Truth Behind America's Low-Carb Diet, as well as other books.
Yep. So the books that we've read just recently of his is How to Survive a Pandemic, which is obviously very apt right at the moment, as we're all trying to go through this and starts living in a slightly different way would be good, and a more healthy way. And to aid with that healthy way of living, we also read the book How Not to Die, which is a fantastic book in the way, let's be clear. We didn't read it. We listened to the audio book because we've been extremely busy. But fortunately, he narrates it himself. And it's narrated very, very well by an extremely passionate man.
And I think also I consider myself lucky to not have the time to read it, because you can actually see the charismatic man that he is. You can hear the passion in his voice and the knowledge and all the enthusiasm and the really cool jokes. We really appreciated listening to the two books.
Absolutely. Generally, I'm a big fan of audiobooks. I'm also a very big fan of audiobooks that are narrated by the author. I just think it gives it that next level.
But it is indeed.
Anyway, I think we should get on with the show. It's a shorter show than normal because he's so busy, but it was packed full of interesting information. So let's get on and listen to Dr. Michael Greger. Hello and welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. We are here and delighted to be here with Dr. Michael Greger.
How are you?
Happy to be here. I'm so excited.
Fantastic. Thank you.
We're going to be going straight into the questions quick. Firstly, can we ask you about your book, How Not to Die? And thanks for writing and narrating that for us, because with our busy lives, we can only listen to it in the car. So we are listening to books these days rather than reading them. You're talking about the major causes of premature death and the solution for it. Could you quickly explain what are the major causes and what's the easy solution for all these?
Yeah, so How Not to Die split up into two parts. The first half is just 15 chapters on each of the 15 leading causes of death, talking about the role diet may play in preventing, arresting, or reversing each of our 15 top killers. In the second half, I center my recommendations around a daily dozen checklist of the healthiest of healthy foods. I encourage people to try to fit into their daily routine. So, for example, greens every day, the healthiest vegetables, berries every day, the healthiest fruits, legumes, the best beverages, the best sweeteners, how much exercise to get every day, quarter teaspoon of turmeric, tablespoon of ground flax seeds, et cetera, et cetera. Just trying to inspire people to include some of these healthy foods into their daily diet. But the, more broadly, the diet found to not only prevent arrest, but even reverse some of our top killers, including heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and high blood pressure, is a diet centered around whole plant foods.
And your Daily Dozen is an app as well, yes? It's a free app, downloadable. We have it.
It is a free app, Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen, on iPhone, Android, and indeed, everything's free. Everything on the website is free. The app is free. I'm not selling anything. It's not commercial. No corporate sponsorship. We're just a 501c3 nonprofit and doing it out of a labor of love.
That's fantastic.
Is great. We do use your app. I actually, and I make sure that our kids and we have all the required nutrition for every day. Sometimes I skip filling it in, but it's still there to remind me what I need to.
Great, perfect. That's exactly what it's there for.
And the kids are getting it without even knowing.
Exactly.
Excellent. That's what we like to see: a healthy new generation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Berries ice cream. It's perfect. you also talk about the lack of nutritional knowledge and experience from doctors. And do you think that's changing recently? And what would you say to doctors that are not equipped with that knowledge?
Yeah, you know, doctors unfortunately have a severe nutrition deficiency in education. Most doctors were just not taught about the impact healthy nutrition can have on the course of illness. And so they graduate without this powerful tool in their medical toolbox. There's also institutional barriers, time constraints, lack of reimbursement. Sometimes doctors just aren't paid for counseling patients on how to take better care of themselves. It's more of a problem, I think, here in the States. And drug companies as well play a role in influencing medical education and practice. Yeah, you can ask your doctor when's the last time they were taken out to dinner by Big Broccoli. It's probably been a while. But things are changing. In fact, there's a whole new specialty called lifestyle medicine, one of the fastest growing medical specialties. I'm proud to be a founding member of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. So this is using lifestyle approaches such as diet and exercise, not only to prevent disease, but to potentially arrest and reverse it as well. And so there's a whole new generation of doctors that are really shifting. And the greatest interest is among the medical students who, want to not just, slow down the rate at which their patients die of chronic disease, but actually treat the cause and, reverse the course, which is why, of course, we went to medical school in the first place.
Yeah. It gives us all hope, doesn't it, that we're seeing this change?
I love it. Hopefully it'll come soon enough.
Exactly. So here in Australia and in many countries around the world, the governments are refusing to acknowledge that and look at the strong evidence towards leading a healthy plant-based diet. What's even in schools here, actually in Australia, Dairy Australia still sponsor the school curriculum. So kids are learning from their curriculum.
Yeah, well, they're marketing more or less.
Exactly, they're marketing. Yeah. True. What needs to change?
Well, the same thing's happening here in the States with the National Dairy Council as providing a lot of the educational materials for schools, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, etc. But not all countries are ignoring the science. Canada is actually taking the lead revising their dietary guidelines. For the first time, they actually excluded those with industry interests from the scientific panel, so all of a sudden dairy disappeared. As if they used to have dairy as a food group, now they just tell people to drink water. Of course, that was the science all along, but it was just there were, conflicts of industry interest. And so they have, not surprisingly, come out with the most kind of plant-forward recommendations, sticking, closer to the science. And that's really all we're asking. We're just saying, look, these guidelines should be based on the best available balance of evidence. And the best available balance of evidence is that we should center our diets around whole, healthy plant foods. So minimize our intake of meat, eggs, dairy, and processed junk, and maximize our intake of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes like beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, nuts and seeds, herbs and spices, mushrooms, basically real food that grows out of the ground. These are our healthiest choices.
Absolutely, absolutely. And would you say, or are you seeing, we're obviously there with the example of Canada, but are you seeing a loosening of industrial agriculture's kind of grip on the government in other places, or is it still pretty, pretty strong?
The agriculture lobby is pretty strong everywhere. And so there's often this kind of conflict of interest, where the Ministry of Agriculture is kind of placed in charge of the dietary guidelines. So, for example, here in the States, the USDA has this dual role. They're the ones that does the meat inspections and the dietary guidelines, but they're also, their whole mission is to promote agricultural products.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to, eat more messaging, they're great. They're like front and center, eat more fruits and vegetables, right?
Yeah.
But when they go again, when they tell people to eat less of something, right? Then that kind of goes against some of their core policies. And so they say things like eat less saturated and trans fatty acids, which of course no one knows what that means. What that means, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, is eat less meat and dairy, but they can't come out and actually say that.
Yeah.
Because, it would kind of be bad for the agriculture industry, for the sugar industry. Some countries, for example, the UK, have separated that out. So they actually got rid of the Ministry of Agriculture and separated it out. This was during the mad cow debacle. And realized that the people in charge of food safety should not be the same people who are promoting these products because they have this inherent conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
And so whenever that's done, when we actually put dietary guidelines in charge, not of the agriculture professionals, not in charge, but in terms of the healthcare professionals, then we actually see guidelines that are much more evidence-based. And again, that's all we're really asking. It's a wonderful organization in Europe, stationed primarily out of Germany, called ProVeg, who are actually launching kind of a dietary guidelines campaign working with citizens and groups within countries to basically petition their governments to stick to the science, basically, and to try to root out some of these industry interests. And that can have a big effect, not just on kind of, what kind of recommendations are coming out, but in many countries, though the agricultural policies, like what's being served in government institutions such as prisons and schools and, offices, often adheres to those guidelines. So whatever the guidelines say can, make a difference for millions of meals a day, which is why the industry is so, hell-bent on making sure that they don't tell people to stop eating their products. So their shift is happening, but we can't wait, right? Mm-hmm. The health and well-being of our families are such, we can't wait till the powers that be come out. Just like, back here in the States in the 1950s, we had a mountain of evidence that smoking was causing lung cancer, but it wasn't until 1964 with the Surgeon General's report finally admitting, yes, there are 6,000 studies, that implicating smoking and lung cancer, smoking causes lung cancer. So wait a second. Couldn't we give people a heads up at 5,000 studies or something? It's like, there just has to be such this overwhelming, mountain of evidence. And so, we're here in the 1950s where the government has yet to say, okay, finally, this is the healthiest diet. But the science has said that. In fact, you can go to truehealthinitiative.org, which is kind of like the IPCC of nutrition. Okay. Like instead of getting all the climate scientists together and saying, okay, what's the real facts when it comes to climate change? They got together the hundreds of the top nutrition professionals in the world to agree to a consensus statement as to what is the healthiest diet for human beings. And so you can check it out at truehealthinitiative.org. And spoiler alert, it's a diet centered around whole plant foods.
Shocker. We didn't think that was going to happen. it is frustrating, the government hold and the misinformation due to their both personal and political requirements to line their pockets. I can't, for want of better words, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's understandable, right? I mean, look, if you're a dairy farmer, you're going to tout the benefits of dairy. If you're a soda industry mogul, you're going to downplay the risks of sugar. I mean, that's just how the world works. But, it's fine if someone wants to put an ad on TV. But when we're talking about public policy, when we're talking about some of our most vulnerable populations, like what's being fed in hospitals, senior citizens homes and to our school children. I mean, then we really need to kind of, just look at the science and put aside some of these commercial interests.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're a plant-based family, us and our kids. And we recently read a study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. I think it was in April. And this stirred up a lot of headlines about vegan children being shorter, having weaker bones. What would you comment regarding this study?
Oh, I'm in book writing mode, and so I have not been following what's been happening. But I will get to the study certainly. I mean, so I have not seen. I don't know if it's cross-sectional analysis or exactly what they looked at. But until this point, all we had was the Adventist data, which showed that if anything, vegetarians were actually an inch taller. Vegetarian children were an inch taller than their non-vegetarian colleagues. And certainly not only taller, but thinner. Which is important in terms of our pandemic of childhood obesity. But in terms of, this new study, I saw the headlines too. And I made a note to cover it next time I sit down and do videos, but have to finish How Not to Age first, which will be out December 2022.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that one because you and I are very similar age, and I'm feeling it suddenly in my knees and my elbows. So I'll be reading that with a lot of interest.
Great.
So for people not living a whole food plant-based diet, what would you recommend they remove from their diets to ensure as optimal a health as they can?
Yeah, if there were just three things I would remove first from anyone's diet, it would be anything with trans fats. Number two would be processed meats, bacon, ham, hot dogs, lunch meat, because we know they cause cancer. And then third would be liquid candy, soda, sugar sweetened beverages. Those are probably the first three things I would remove from people's diet. And if there were just three things to add to someone's diet, the first three things, it would be, berries, the healthiest fruits, greens, the healthiest vegetables, and then some kind of legume. So lentil soup or hummus or something like that. It's important to get our legumes in every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that frustrates me with, I guess, like we love berries or all sorts of berries, but what we're finding is that they are almost being priced out of people's tables at the moment. And that is very, I mean, certainly here, I mean,
even
at the moment,
even frozen?
Frozen slightly better,
yeah.
But
yeah.
For example, a small punnet or a carton of
blueberries
is $7 to $9.
Oh my God. Brutal.
It is. And that worries me that it's being
go frozen. Yeah.
Yeah, we do. As I said,
You stock up. And look, if there's a sale on frozen, you just fill up half your freezer, right? I mean, what are you going to do? Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We are talking about sugary drinks. For people that are still following a calories diet, there seems to be a manipulated argument between calories and ignoring calorie density. Could you elaborate briefly on that?
You mean ignoring calorie density for beverages?
Not specifically for beverages, but I think one of the examples you gave a while ago was carrots and Coca-Cola.
Oh, right. Right. No. So calorie density is critically important. And the example I gave was, in fact, it came out of, I think it was an editorial from the current and former chair of nutrition at Harvard, where they're talking about how Coca-Cola makes this argument that, the 100 calories of Coca-Cola is no different than 100 calories of carrots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so in a laboratory setting, that's true. I mean, 100 calories is 100 calories. But then, wait a second, you got to actually do the math. I forget how many calories was in the can of Coke, but the equivalent number, the amount of carrots you would have to eat, it would take you like 4 hours to eat that many carrots. And you could chug that soda down a few minutes.
Yeah.
And I don't think you could even fit that many carrots in your stomach. It was actually, I think it's like 5 cups of carrots and you only really have 4 cups of space in your stomach. So it's like, that gives you a sense of calorie density. So there's a lot more calories per unit volume, per weight, in that soda than there is in the carrots. And so yes, technically a calorie is a calorie, but, you could get 2000, you fill up your entire 2000 allotment of calories with, 2 pints of strawberry ice cream. But I think it would take like 30 cups of strawberries themselves. You couldn't eat that many strawberries. I mean, there's some foods that are so low in calorie density, you'd have to eat like wheelbarrows full of food a day, and there's just not enough stomach volume. So that's the nice thing about healthy foods like fruits and vegetables. You eat all you want. You just like can't overeat. It's kind of impossible to overeat. You eat as much as you want, and you don't have to worry about calorie counting or portion control or any of that, because it all just kind of naturally takes care of itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we move on to talk about your other book, How to Survive a Pandemic? And it's obviously extremely relevant right now. We are very short of time, and I know you're busy, so we're trying to kind of get as much information as we can. You talk about the imminent risk of pandemics and their causes, and we're in a pandemic now. Do you think that we are risking having bigger ones?
Oh, so, I mean, it's really important, as terrible, as catastrophic as this current pandemic has been, primarily financially around the world, though the deaths are stacking up, this is a remarkably mild pandemic compared to how it certainly could be. So, I haven't looked at the latest case fatality rates, but last time I looked, it was like 0.4. So, like 1 in 200 people. That get infected would die, which is of course terribly tragic. But if you look at something like the 1918 flu, for example, then it was more like 2%. So it's like 1 in 50. That's you can imagine. And then of course we have these bird flu viruses running around, like H5N1, H7N9, which has, 40, 50, 60% case fatality rates. Of course, only a few thousand people have been infected. So it's very hard to transmit from birds to people. But once it does, can you imagine a flu virus with, a flip of the coin, whether you're gonna live or not? I mean, imagine if something that catastrophic acquired easy human to human transmissibility, either naturally or in a laboratory setting, since we know you can make flu viruses that are transmissible, literally infecting billions of people within a matter of months. And we can make flu viruses, little did we know until bird flu came along, that have this Ebola-like catastrophic, greater than 50% fatality. If nature doesn't pull it together, then some bad actor could potentially do that, particularly now with synthetic biology and the capability, so far. And so, the thought of a truly mind-boggling, civilization-shaking event. I mean, right now, look, doctors and nurses are still showing up to work. There's food on the shelves. So civilization goes on. But you can imagine who's showing up to work if there's a flip of the coin death rate.
Exactly.
Bodies in the street kind of thing. That's why it's critically important that we take steps to try to decrease our risk of these kind of catastrophic events, and really go to the source, which is this kind of human-animal interaction. And we really need to change the way that we're interacting with animals, raising animals, such to decrease the risk of some kind of catastrophic pandemic. Now, with swine flu, our last pandemic in 2009, though only about 500,000 Americans here died of it, it shows, oh, now we have a whole other species we have to worry about, the fact that flu viruses can jump straight from pigs to people. And so now we got to think about how we're raising pigs as well. But so, there's a lot to do, but whenever possible, we should try to treat the cause.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned also about avian flus, and obviously the way, let's say, mass chicken farming is done with cages and things like that. What makes that so suitable for these viruses to develop and then transmit between all the birds and so forth, and then potentially out to us?
Right. So we confine tens of thousands of animals in these cramped, filthy football field-sized sheds to lie beak to beak or snout to snout atop their own waist. It's just a breeding ground for disease. So there's a sheer number of animals. The concentration, the ammonia from the decomposing waste burning their lungs. It's like a perfect storm environment, in terms of, you know, if you wanted to kind of play Russian roulette with these viruses, to kind of ramp up virulence, since there's no kind of evolutionary disadvantage of killing your host too quickly because you're just stacked up next to one another. And so that's able to take some harmless, intestinal bug of waterfowl, these influenza viruses, which exist for millions of years without causing a problem, until we domesticated ducks and other waterfowl, and then we started getting human influenza problems. And now with the increased intensification of pig and poultry production, particularly in areas in Asia since the 1980s, we're seeing this unprecedented rise. A dozen new bird flu viruses that can jump directly from birds to people. This is something just unheard of in kind of a historical standpoint. And the concern is one of these will acquire human-to-human transmissibility.
Absolutely, absolutely. So some of us are going back to, or post-pandemic, going back to our normal lives, and some slightly trying to change. How inevitable would you say the next pandemic is, in your opinion, if we carry on with this kind of the status quo, the new normal?
New pandemics are inevitable. The question is, how bad is it going to be, and how prepared are we going to be, and how we're going to handle it? Hopefully, maybe COVID-19 was kind of the fire drill we needed to kind of wake us out of our complacency and really take a keen look at where these viruses come from in the first place and what we can do to decrease our risk. Probably the most exciting developments have been in plant-based meat and cultured meat, such that here in the States we have Beyond Meat, Impossible Burgers, who are making plant-based meat that's kind of so identical in terms of taste. And hopefully at one point cost and convenience that it would be, a lot of these big chains are, adding, Burger King add the Impossible Burger, that kind of thing. And so people can get kind of the same kind of mouthfeel, the same kind of texture, same kind of taste they all grew up with. I mean, it'd be better for them, better from kind of a greenhouse gas standpoint, better from a pandemic risk standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then the next generation of that is actually real meat cultured. From animal cells, just like we can make, parts of human organs in a lab, we can make animal organs too. We make all the muscle meat we want, which is now being commercialized. Singapore is the first country to start selling it. There's now cultured chicken meat where no chickens were harmed in the production of this chicken meat, but it's actual chicken meat. Now, it's healthier in that there's not a food safety issue because there's no intestines involved. So you don't have to worry about Campylobacter, E. coli, Salmonella, but it's still chicken. But it's chicken without the lungs too. And that's the real pandemic concern. Yeah. And so if you can make chicken without any chicken lungs, without any breathing chickens, that's the way you can reduce risk. Yeah. Because look, we've been at this telling people to eat plant-based, for, you know, years now. People have the information, but only a small percentage of the population is really making the shift. Yeah. Now for them, that's wonderful. You know, in terms of pandemic risk, what everybody eats affects everybody, right? You know, I mean, so you can be as plant-based as you want, but if someone coughs on you from, you know, because some terrible thing has arisen from factory farming, you know, so that's why, some of these, kind of meat alternatives, our hopes that people can kind of eat their meat, have their meat and eat it too, and make it easier to make that transition until, you know, instead of, you know, telling Australians they should eat some broccoli.
Yeah, yeah, which is a hard thing to do.
Right, I can imagine.
So with all that's going on in the world, both in terms of climate change, the human and animal inequalities and abuses, pandemics and everything else, what keeps you up at night?
Oh, yeah, no, it's, I mean, what's been keeping me up at night for over a decade has been pandemic risk. It was only now people are kind of catching up, but I'm like saying, look, what's going on? Right. I mean, my first book on pandemics was 2011 or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, right. The concern that there would be, you know, a pandemic with more than just a, you know, few percent, fatality rate. I mean, it's just unthinkable what that would do in terms of human progress, not to mention all the suffering that would cause. And, you know, you just, unfortunately, you don't kind of shore up the levees until after the disaster hits. But, yeah. You know, hopefully it won't take a horrible pandemic like that before we realize the true cost of cheap chicken.
Absolutely.
Exactly. What makes you optimistic for the future?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, as I said, the fact that, that some of the largest meat producers in the world, Smithfield, Tyson, Perdue, they're coming out with their own lines of plant-based products. So it's the meat companies. And look, the meat companies, they just want to make money. They don't care. In fact, it's so much easier to make some plant-based chicken instead of having to worry about slaughterhouse workers and injuries and diseases. And I mean, it's like, look, to their vision at kind of reorienting themselves to be like, we're protein companies, right? Mm-hmm. We just want to make money. And look, if we can make money selling this kind of protein, then fine, let's do it. And so that's, so it's no longer kind of these niche markets for, you know, vegetarians. The fact that, so for example, Smithfield, largest pork producer in the world, has an entire plant-based line. I think it was, is it Tyson or Purdue? One of the big poultry manufacturers making plant-based chicken. Oh no, Cargill. Cargill, one of the biggest meat producers in the world, is making, a plant-based chicken nuggets for KFC across China. Right? I mean, it's just like, what kind of weird, bizarro world are we in? but that's really exciting. The fact that it's gone so mainstream, have these large restaurant chains doing it. And so we're seeing these kind of big shifts. That's really, you know, making it just as easy as possible for people, to, you know, diversify their protein sources. That's exciting.
Absolutely. It is. The world is definitely changing. Let's hope we're changing in time.
Yeah,
that's right.
If you were to ask our audience to change one thing to save our planet, what would that be? How can it be good?
Ay, ay, ay. Oh, it's super simple. A plant-based diet.
Fantastic. That's what we want to hear. Thank you very much.
So that was Dr. Michael Greger, as I'm sure you heard, an extremely passionate man and also so incredibly knowledgeable. And we've taken a lot of advice from his books ourselves in terms of how we live and how our kids live and everything else like that. So yeah, I think it was good. He's so excited about things. It's great.
It is. It is. It's nice to see someone so positive about life. And I urge you to read the books, especially How Not to Die and How to Survive a Pandemic. I think we're waiting for his next book now, How Not to Grow Old. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, you mentioned, I think I need that one, definitely.
And, but yes, if you are in your journey to change your diet and to become more plant-based, How Not to Die is a really good book.
Yeah.
And just takes you through the reasons why consuming meat and dairy products are so dangerous to us, but also the solutions. And with that,
it's very solution-based.
It is really good. With that, I want to recommend the Daily Dozen. I actually have it on my phone. It's a checklist, and it's free. You can just download it. And you just literally go day-to-day basis and check the foods that are good for you to eat on your day-to-day.
Yeah. And nutritionfacts.org.
Yes, yeah, nutritionfacts.org.
Is a very, very good place to go to as well. Mm. Lots of other interviews on there that Dr. Michael Greger's done, but also recipes, details about all types of food, about ailments and what foods can help and everything like that as well. It's an exceptionally good website.
It is indeed. And I also want to urge you to read or to listen to How to Survive a Pandemic. This book has scared me. I think there's a lot of information that people do not know about. Of how close we are in contact with viruses, and from our food production, how we treat the animals that we produce for food, and how that can affect our health.
Yeah.
So please listen or read to the book. It's a really good book to get that kind of knowledge from, especially as we are in the midst of a pandemic now.
Absolutely. And we'll put all the details to those in our show notes. Mm. And to get to our show notes is all the W's, howtobegood.com.au. So go there, you'll get the show notes and summation of the show and links and everything else in there as well. Mm. And as always, we are a self-funded podcast, video podcast. Is that what it's called now? I don't know. We'll work that out.
Podcast.
We're self-funded either way. So if you would like to help us out and splash some dosh to keep this going and keep some fantastic guests on the show, then please visit our Patreon site, which again can be found through www.howtobegood.com.au. Mm. And share, subscribe, follow us. And we will speak to you again with another fantastic guest coming up soon. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.